In the latest, the Pentagon has deployed B-52 bombers to West Asia and to what it calls the support of the withdrawal of U.S. troops from the country. That is, if the troops actually withdraw. And even if they eventually do, reports have surfaced that the U.S. will leave over 18,000 military and private contractors and special forces in that country, putting the whole notion of a troop pullout into question. To discuss this a little bit further, first, let's cross on over to Kabul and talk to our correspondent, Amin Alami, who joins us. I mean, at this point, we know what the latest is in terms of the U.S. Having these B-52 bombers on standby. Tell us more about the positioning of the U.S. and whether there's actually any movement when it comes to a troop pullout from that country, along with the coalition forces.
Of course, the top U.S. military commander in Afghanistan just declared that the preparations has begun for the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan, and that American troops are going to hand over all military bases and military equipment to the Afghan security and defense forces in order to help them to fight against terrorist groups, mainly the Taliban, after the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan. But there are doubts also here in Afghanistan about the real pullout of American forces in Afghanistan. I mean that top U.S. military and political officials have so far emphasized that they will not leave Afghanistan alone and they will support this country. It means that the Washington will continue to follow its own interests in Afghanistan via, as you mentioned, using private contractors in order to continue its military presence in Afghanistan beyond the withdrawal of military forces from Afghanistan by September this year. In the meantime, another important fact is that the Afghan government says that the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan will not negatively affect the situation, the security situation in Afghanistan, because Afghanistan's national armed troops are now enough capable to confront, not only confront terrorist groups, but also to strongly pound their positions across this country. For instance, I can briefly point out to the recent remarks of Afghanistan's Defense Minister, General Yasin Zia, who said that Afghan military forces, mainly Afghan Air Force, are conducting heavy military operations across Afghanistan, mainly in southern parts of this country and, of course, in northern provinces of Balkh and Faryab to eliminate the terrorist groups, including Taliban and Daesh. But what remains as a big question is that will the ongoing political efforts lead Afghanistan and the warrior nation here to a lasting peace? Only, I think, the time will answer such a question.
Okay, thank you for that. We appreciate it. That's a correspondent there. Amin Alami talking to us from Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Okay, let's bring in co-founder of Code Pink Media, Benjamin, from Washington, D.C., one of our guests, and also from the Answer Coalition. Richard Becker joins us from San Francisco. Welcome to you both. Media Benjamin, first to you, the U.S. and the coalition forces, the announcement has been made. Do you think that they are sincere when they say there will be a troop pullout from Afghanistan?
There are all of these plans to keep U.S. Proxy war going in a way in terms of the mercenaries who are there, paramilitary units, CIA operative, and the ability to continue to conduct airstrikes on the part of the Afghan government, which is a government that does not have a lot of popular support. So I also think it's important to recognize that according to the agreement that was worked out over a long period of time between the Trump administration and the Taliban, U.S. troops were supposed to have left by May 1st. Now, Joe Biden, as he was campaigning, knew about that agreement. He had plenty of time to make that decision early on when he came in, and instead decided to push the date back to September 11th. And while in the U.S., that doesn't seem like a big problem. On the ground in Afghanistan, I think it is, because April 24th was the date that was going to be a next round of peace talks, and the Taliban pulled out of that because the U.S. had violated the agreement for May 1st. So I think there are, as your person on the ground just said, it remains to be seen how much the U.S. is going to go through with its call to not only pull out the troops, but to stop its involvement in the Afghan war in general.
Richard Becker, you have many who are supporting this, and at the same time, you have many who are not. It's kind of reminiscent of the fact when Donald Trump announced his troop pullout from Syria, many opposition towards that, and many who actually supported it. However, in this case, you're having the opposition in its variety saying that it fears it could create a dangerous power vacuum in the region. Which camp are you in?
Well, I think that the U.S. troops need to withdraw, and the mercenaries need to withdraw as well, the contractors. The problems of Afghanistan can only really be resolved by the Afghan people themselves. And the U.S. has really been in Afghanistan since intervening in 1979, before the Soviet intervention, which was 20 years later, was revealed. There's a great deal that we do not know about the extent of U.S. forces there. I think that if we know from earlier wars, Vietnam War, the wars in Central America, that there were far, far more U.S. forces in the country and in different forms, taking different forms, and with mercenary units as well, than was led on to the public in the United States. The public in the United States does not know what the role, to a very large degree, does not know what the real role of the United States was in destabilizing Afghanistan in ways that have made it very, very difficult to overcome. This is the result of the reckless, imperialist, interventionist policies and the havoc that they wreak on, that those interventions wreak on countries. But, you know, to answer your question once again, only the Afghan people can determine the future of Afghanistan. The occupation needs to end.
Okay, well, maybe Benjamin, you know, we need to discuss this because we just need to, since the U.S. opted to stay in that country for, 20 years, the longest war. Let me get your reaction from one quote that I picked from a 20-year-old veteran of the U.S. Air Force, who, by the way, is against the troop pullout. She said, "We spent almost 20 years in that country, and we have nothing to show for it. It was not a well-thought-out invasion. There was no plan to actually defeat the Taliban terrorists who go into hiding, and then they bide their time and then come back out to fight again." What do you think about what this particular veteran has said?
Well, I'd say it's even worse than that. I mean, we do have something to show for it, and that is the death of countless Afghans and the displacement of so many Afghan citizens, the death of over 2,400 U.S. troops, and the trillions of dollars that could have been spent in really helping poor countries like Afghanistan or improving the lives of people in the United States. So it's not that it's devastating the violence that we perpetrated against the Afghan people, and it's devastating for soldiers and their families. Not only did we lose over 2,400, but tens of thousands were maimed and hurt psychologically in these wars and will live forever with those consequences. So I think that we should recognize that the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan has been an absolute disaster, despite the fact that Biden wants to put a spin on it, that we accomplished our mission, which he says was to bring to justice those who attacked us on 9/11 and to make sure that Afghanistan was not a haven for al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Well, the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan was supposed to bring a stable Afghan government, which it didn't do. Look at the opium production that is going on in Afghanistan today. The fact that the Taliban control over half of the territory. I mean, it has been just an overall abysmal failure.
You know, it's hard, Richard Becker. It sounds like a broken record, but then there's so many ways that different organizations, different people, different officials, common people, etc., who have questioned where the U.S. went wrong and what did it really achieve. One of the particular instances comes back to an investigative journalistic work that was done, which I'm sure that you've heard of it, and that was from the Washington Post, where it was said that even at some point military officials were making up their successes, and that was just to appease the public, but they knew that they had no idea what they were doing in Afghanistan. It just boggles the mind, is what I'm trying to say, as to what went wrong there. Or was that a system by design because there were some gains that were being made that we're not aware of? Is that the case?
Well, there's no question. I don't think there can be any question that when these kind of interventions take place, these really wars against other people, you know, we just have to remember the Vietnam War and that the big scandal when Daniel Ellsberg had been on the side of the government and working for Rand Institute. When he turned against the war and released the Pentagon Papers, you know, they tried to try him for treason, the same way that they tried Chelsea Manning and might have tried Julian Assange and so forth, because they revealed the reality that these kind of imperialist interventions, wars, take place against peoples that are not understood at all by those who are intervening and who are leading those interventions. And so they construct policies which inevitably fail, except in causing, as Medea said, widespread death and destruction in those countries. This happens over and over and over again. You can see in Iraq that U.S. claimed that they had constructed a new national army for Iraq, and we're going to be able to leave. That army collapsed. I don't think the Afghan military is doing much better. And it's not a consequence of what's going on in those countries. It's that foreign occupiers cannot do that. They cannot really construct armies that are national armies because they are really armies that were built by, constructed by, and are really led by foreign interests, in this case, Washington above all. And so it turns into one disaster after another. And it brings about a situation like today. The Taliban is a very reactionary organization. It endangers the rights of women and the public in general. But the reality is that none of this, protracting the war, and the policies that go on with it, that is not going to lead to anything but more disaster.
Yeah, it's a. What I find very interesting is, Media Benjamin, that both you and our guest there, Richard Becker, mentioned the word contractors that are going to remain in that country. Well, this was a stunner, and the way that both of you mentioned contractors, in a sense, I was skimming over it, even though you made your point clear. But the stunner was when the news came out after the announcement that Biden isn't ending the Afghanistan war. He's actually privatizing it, special forces, Pentagon contractors, intelligence operatives, to remain 18,000 of them. And that doesn't sound like a true pullout. Is that figure something that shocks you? And is this something that shocks you when you hear about how many may remain in that country? According to this report, about 18,000 of them.
Yes, I think the issue is that we don't know, that there is no transparency. There used to be some more transparency, for example, about how many sorties the U.S. was carrying out. It used to be public information. But that was stopped during the Trump time, and it's continued under Biden. So we don't even know what the continuation of U.S. airstrikes are. And certainly we are never told the truth about how many contractors, how many CIA operatives, how many special forces. This is not public information. So I think the public in the U.S. is quite happy with the idea that the U.S. troops are leaving, but very few people have probably even read those reports that say, uh-oh, there's a little caveat in this, that the U.S. troops leaving does not mean an end to the U.S. engagement. But I think there will continue to be pressure on the Biden administration to stop its involvement in Afghanistan, because we won't be able to control what happens when U.S. troops have gone. And I think it will become clearer and clearer that no matter what forces the U.S. keeps there, it will not be able to prop up an unpopular, corrupt Afghan government. And as Richard said, it's not that we want the Taliban to take over. They are an incredibly regressive force. But it is just an example of how the Taliban are local people. They are not going anywhere. And they've said they will not stop fighting until U.S. forces have left. Now, they're not going to count, oh, it's just U.S. troops and it's only these other contractors. No, they're going to consider them foreign forces, and they won't stop fighting until the foreign forces have left.
You have this report by The Times, Richard Becker, that says the U.S. will maintain maintains actually a constellation of air bases in the Persian Gulf region, as well as in Jordan, and a major air headquarters in Qatar, which would provide a launching pad for long-range bombers or armed drone missions into Afghanistan. This sounds like a broader plan, which means that the U.S. would attack Afghanistan whenever it wants, because based on the number of mercenaries, special forces, and intelligence operatives that are going to remain there, they're going to go after when they deem it necessary to kill either al-Qaeda elements or you have Daesh there, or if it goes after the Taliban. So is this part of the bigger picture?
Yeah, undoubtedly. I mean, we know a tiny percentage of what really goes on and how the war is conducted inside of Afghanistan. It's much more hidden than it used to be. One of the Pentagon's lessons of Vietnam was don't let people know what you're doing. So, you know, starting particularly with the Iraq War, but even earlier with the wars in Central America, very, very little was released by the military about what they were actually doing. And the same thing, I think, goes here. So the forces that are going to remain in the country, apparently the mercenary forces, the contractors, as well as the how close to Afghanistan are all these U.S., many, many, many U.S. military bases. I wanted to add one other thing that I think is important to consider, and that is right now the U.S.'s number one enemy that it's targeting is China. Afghanistan has a border with China, a small border. Afghanistan has a huge border with Iran, another target of U.S. aggression. And so that has to fit into this whole picture. And, you know, the surrounding of China is taking place mostly in the eastern and southern areas of joining China, but the aim really is to, in the pivot to Asia, is to surround China, and the preparations for war against China are going forward.
So is that what's happening, Media Benjamin, based on what Richard Becker said there? Do you agree?
Yes, there's been an effort since the time of Obama to get the troops out of these, quote, endless wars and move towards China. And we certainly see that during the Biden administration. There's talk about getting troops out of Iraq as well. The problem is they keep getting bogged down because they don't want to leave in failure. I think the Iran nuclear deal is an important piece of this. If the Biden administration can do its job in lifting the sanctions against Iran and getting back into the deal, that can help to ease the tensions both in Afghanistan and in the Middle East. And that's something that we in the U.S. have to push this administration to fulfill its promises that it made on the Iran nuclear deal and its promises that it made in over a year of talks with the Taliban to withdraw the U.S. presence.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much. We do appreciate it. Amin Alami was a correspondent who spoke to us at the top of the hour. Also, Media Benjamin there, co-founder of Code Pink from Washington, D.C. And thank you, Richard Becker, from the Answer Coalition from San Francisco. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitale, my entire team in the capital, Tehran. It's goodbye. Until next time.
gifted and Safi, Ramadan Mubarak, Goli Records.
Ramadan Mubarak, لكل مسلم.
Insights into the Holy Quran, a special program for the holy month of Ramadan.
Welcome you, O holy man of blessings. You are seeking nearness to my Creator, for you my soul and heart has been purified.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. This is a special program for the holy month of Ramadan. In today's program, Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi explains some verses related to this blessed month. Please stay with us.
O month of mercy, you bring so much good. We pray that it never ends. Well, we know you gotta go as the seasons come and go, 'cause your time is set by Allah. Oh, Ramadan, oh, Ramadan, you're the month of the noble Quran.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. We're going to be with you in this holy month of Ramadan, talking about the different verses of the Holy Quran regarding the benefits of fasting, the most important of them, piety or taqwa. We'll be with you again after you have listened to some verses of the Holy Quran regarding fasting.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Ya
O you who have believed, decreed upon you is fasting as it was decreed upon those before you, that you may become righteous.
Brothers and sisters, the verse that we were talking about was the verse in chapter Baqarah. Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu kutiba alaykum as-siyam kama kutiba alal ladhina min qablikum la'allakum tattaqun. O you who believe, fasting is prescribed for you as it was prescribed before you, that you may gain self-restraint. لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ. We mentioned in this regard that this taqwa can be achieved by not just stopping at the first level of fasting, which was just the jurisprudential level. This taqwa cannot be achieved merely by refraining yourself from eating and drinking. Now let's just get to the most important question in our discussion. What is the meaning of taqwa? I mean, what does it really mean? The word taqwa, or piety, means to fear Allah and to guard against evil. And it is, you may have seen that it is frequently used by experts, and it has been recommended by so many people. There are different verses in the Holy Quran that can help us have a better view on this word. One meaning is fear and awe. The Holy Quran says, "Me alone should you fear." In some other verse, it has been used in the meaning of obedience and worship. The Holy Quran says, "Be careful of your duty to Allah with the care that which is due to Him." حَقَّ تُقَاتِ. It has also been used as purifying the hearts from the sins. The Holy Quran says, "And he who obeys Allah and His Apostle and fears Allah and is careful of his duty to Him, these it is that are the achievers." Some believe, dear listeners, that this last meaning is the real meaning of taqwa, and not the first two meanings, that is, obedience or fear.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
شهر رمضان الذي أنزل فيه القرآن هدى للناس وبينات من الهدى والفرقان فمن شهد منكم الشهر فليصم ومن كان مريضا أو على سفر فعدة من أيام أخر يريد الله بكم اليسر ولا يريد بكم العسر ولتكملوا العدة ولتكبروا الله عَلَى مَا هَدَاكُمْ وَلَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ.
The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it. And whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which He has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
Taqwa originally comes from the word waqaya, which means to ban and to keep away. It is also said that taqwa comes from waqaya, meaning safeguard or protection. Now let's discuss the views of some lexicographers regarding this word. Raghib says, waqaya is to keep the thing from what harms it, and taqwa is to guard self from what it fears. He further adds that taqwa is to guard self against sin. Its realization depends on abandoning what has been generally forbidden and even some of the permissible acts. In this regard, Allama Majlisi, may his soul rest in peace, says taqwa means to safeguard, it means self-restraint, and generally speaking, it means to keep self from what harms it in hereafter. And the more it is restricted, it will be better for the self. Imam Ali alayhi salam has been quoted as saying, taqwa is to avoid sins. Also, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, when he was asked about the meaning of taqwa, said, taqwa is to be present in a place God has ordered, and to be absent from a place He has prohibited. A great part of supplications signify the same meaning. O Allah, find me not in a place You have forbidden. And this could help us to reach the general total meaning of taqwa. So, from what we discussed, we can infer that taqwa is self-restraint and safeguarding yourself from what is against the Lord, what is against the Almighty Allah has ordered. In this way, taqwa can cover all the meanings that we mentioned. It has a sense of fear, it has a sense of obedience and worship, and it also has the sense of purifying the heart. And fasting, if done in the correct way, can help us achieve this piety or self-restraint. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRB English Radio, for listening to us. If you have any question or comment, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at farstoday.com. May Allah accept your deeds in this holy month of Ramadan, and please include all Muslims in your prayers. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Forgive us and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Around the world with reporters.
The Palestinian Authority, along with different political factions, held Israel fully responsible for the serious deterioration in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds over the past few days and called on the international community to put pressure on the Israeli regime to stop its provocations. Israeli police and settler violence erupted in the area on Thursday night and continued through Friday, leaving over 100 of Palestinians wounded and scores more arrested.
Since the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, Israeli forces had been escalating measures against the people there, starting by cutting off loudspeakers of Al-Aqsa Mosque. That's why our people in Al-Quds are protesting and rising against oppression and crimes by the Israeli regime.
But the issue is not only between the Israeli police and the Palestinians. Since the start of the holy month of Ramadan, every night hundreds of Israeli settlers rush to the streets of the holy city and assault Palestinians under the protection of the Israeli forces. The extremist settlers chant death to Arabs during their marches. Hundreds of ultra-nationalist Israelis marched through central Jerusalem towards the Damascus Gate, which police had barricaded as a precaution.
Verbal condemnation of Israel over the aggression is not enough. The Palestinian factions must offer all forms of support to Al-Quds and its residents. Palestinians must stand united behind Al-Quds. What's going on is an uprising, and here in occupied West Bank, protests and demonstrations should continue. This is the least we can do to defend Al-Quds.
Palestinians say Israeli police want to prevent them from saying their prayers and the usual Ramadan evening gatherings at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and outside the Damascus Gate.
Protests which have flared up in Jerusalem Al-Quds have now spilled over to the occupied West Bank in defense of the Holy City and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinians warned that Tel Aviv is heading towards a heavy-handed crackdown against them in the occupied territories to ward off another surge in Palestinians' protests and anger. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Nowadays, Afghan security and military forces are witnessing the last months of the presence of their US-led NATO allies. These forces are determined to protect their country against any threats on their own without any outside help. As top military officials here say, the Afghan armed forces will overcome any challenges after the pullout of foreign troops by drawing on the experience they have gained in fighting terrorism over the past two decades.
Currently, US-led NATO forces are stationed in their bases only in Bagram and Balkh provinces, but they will leave these key bases too. We won't be worried about this because our forces have, over the past two decades, gained enough experience on how to counter terrorists.
Confirming that Afghan military and security forces are still in need of financial support, the Afghan government says the good news is that foreign forces will hand over military hardware to the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces when they leave the country by September 11.
Based on our negotiations with foreign military officials, they will hand over weapons and other military equipment worth $1 billion to Afghan National Defense and Security Forces when they leave the country.
According to experts here, because the Afghan National Armed Forces are popular among locals, Afghan people are expected to stand by these troops and support any possible scenario that might unfold after the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan. Still, they urge both the Afghan government and the Taliban to set aside their differences and use the Afghan peace process as a great opportunity to put an end to the decades-long misery of the war-weary nation.
Unfortunately, we have gained nothing from peace summits over the past 2 years. Instead, war in the country has intensified. I think it is high time that both sides forgot about military options, set aside their differences, and launched meaningful negotiations to end the war here.
Top Afghan security officials say they stand ready to safeguard the nation in case the Taliban continue to insist on saying no to negotiations.
According to the head of Afghanistan's National Directorate of Security, the Taliban is now weaker than ever due to alleged rifts between the militant group's main leadership in Quetta Shura and its offshoot in Pakistan's Peshawar. This is thought to be a major stumbling block if the militants seek to put up a fight against some 300,000 Afghan security and defense forces after the withdrawal of nearly 10,000 foreign troops from Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Indian-administered Kashmir has seen a surge in coronavirus cases in times with the rest of the country. The pandemic was almost brought under control in February in the region, but within weeks, the numbers have swollen again to around 18,000 positive cases. Healthcare experts equally blame Kashmir's administration and locals for the spike. Despite the risks, the administration in Kashmir allowed and organized spring festivals. They were attended by thousands without following precautions, leading to a resurge in coronavirus cases. And to worsen things, tourists' inflow to Kashmir went unchecked. Kashmir has hardly witnessed normalcy since August 2019, when India unilaterally stripped the region of its autonomous status. Now, amid the second wave of the pandemic, fresh tensions are expected as new lockdowns would collapse the region's economy. Farooq Ahmed Shah, a hotelier, is discussing the ongoing situation with his staff. He's worried, but not for himself.
We have witnessed back-to-back lockdowns. Unfortunately, we do hiring every year, but with no time, we have to lay off. I'm not much worried about my business. But for these young men who have no source of daily income or savings that can sustain them in tough times, Kashmir's economy has always been suffering. But since 2019, Kashmir is witnessing horrible times and people are forced into poverty.
Kashmir's economy is dependent on tourism and agriculture. This year, the region witnessed year-long bookings in advance. However, the new wave of the pandemic in India has triggered panic and cancellations.
Pandemic since 2020 has 100% affected us, but you know, from November, the tourism started reviving, and December mid onwards, it was getting better, and from January, Kashmir was 100%, almost 100% packed, if not 100, but 80% for sure. So since March ending, you know, due to the surge in cases across country, the tourism is coming down again. It is a huge loss for the industry.
However, Shamim and many others like him are more worried for Kashmir's health infrastructure. They fear a looming disaster if the coronavirus situation is not taken seriously.
With more than 18,000 active coronavirus cases in Jammu and Kashmir, the administration of this conflict-torn region is at a crossroads. The question is whether to impose a lockdown and face its economic consequences or endanger people and overload the fractured health sector. To break the chain of infections, the administration is trying its best. However, the people also have to act responsibly. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Coviran is inching closer to the market. The Iranian-made vaccine kick-started the third human trial phase after proving safe and effective against the virus in previous trials. The third phase will involve injecting the jabs to a statistical population of 20,000 volunteers. Developers say they're certain that the vaccine provides immunity of up to 70% against the coronavirus. But it's only after the third phase that an accurate figure can be achieved.
Already we have achieved the figures, but because we want to have more figures, so in third clinical trial stage, you have to go for more, people to vaccinate. And that's why in third phase, we include more people, like 20,000 in compared with 200 or 280 in second phase.
The headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order, which is in charge of Coviran's development, says it has already launched the production lines of the vaccines due to emergency.
Coviran factories are built in two phases. The first phase, which is complete and ready for use, has a capacity to produce up to 3.5 billion doses of Coviran jabs each month. The second phase, which is under construction, will produce 15 million doses per month. Both will work in full swing once we receive the necessary permits in almost 2 months.
Coviran works based on an inactivated coronavirus. Its developers say lab results indicate that it's also effective against new variants of the virus. Other than Coviran, Iran is working on 7 other homegrown vaccines, each based on a different platform to immunize the human body against COVID-19. This as the country has already started vaccination of the most vulnerable groups, mainly using Russia's Sputnik V.
Once the third phase is over, Coviran will be the first ever Iranian-made COVID vaccine that makes its way to the market. This as Iran is grappling with the fourth and most lethal ever wave of the pandemic, which has put biotech firms in a race against time to get their jabs to the mass production stage. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
While many in America are celebrating an extremely rare murder conviction for a police officer for the killing of George Floyd, demands for police reform are only growing louder. Police in the United States kill about 1,000 people every year, so there's no chance the issue will go away. This month in Chicago, the nation's third largest but deadliest city, a 13-year-old boy was killed by police even though he clearly had his hands up in surrender. Eliminating systemic racism in law enforcement and implementing criminal justice reform is being demanded in the streets and in newspaper headlines, but tax money continues to be invested in more guns and war materiel. The combined spending of America's state and local budgets on police would rank as the world's third largest military expenditure. Last year, the city of Chicago received $500 million in discretionary spending from the first major federal stimulus package. $300 million were handed to the city's police department instead of going to build the public health systems in communities devastated by the pandemic.
That's disgusting. That's not where the CARES Act money was supposed to go. There are communities, vulnerable and marginalized communities, that are not having basic needs met, while the CPD gets the newest, shiniest equipment. And that's just not right. Our demand up front right now today is to promise to have a public discussion to reassess and redistribute that money.
New President Joe Biden openly opposes defunding the police, but many hoped that with an executive order, he would at least place limits on the transfer of military equipment to local law enforcement. That hasn't happened. The Security Reform Policy Institute found that the flow of military gear has been faster under Biden than under Donald Trump.
Fundamentally, as in American cultures, we are reactionary. We don't like to deal with the root of a cause. What we need to do is think about why and how we can fix these solutions from a fundamental level. Education, mental health resources, and in general, affordable housing, public transportation. Anything that we can do to fix the foundational level, sure, it's going to take us longer. Sure, it's a longer process with the communities, lots more discussion, but that's the only way these problems will truly get solved.
The George Floyd Justice in Policing Act was approved by the House of Representatives in March, but it is not expected to be approved by the upper chamber Senate. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
We don't get it!
The Mujahideen Brigades held a military drill to show its readiness in fight against Israeli forces. The drill, named Effective Promise, was held in several parts of the enclave, simulating many defensive combat scenarios on the ground and sea. The drill also sent a clear message to the Zionist regime that the resistance will fight back the crimes committed against Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds in light of the recent clashes in the Holy City.
This drill serves as a clear message to Israel that the resistance front is ready to face any aggression. This is also a message of support to our sons in Jerusalem al-Quds, who are fighting the Zionists with all their strength.
Attending the establishment anniversary of Mujahideen brigades, leaders of Palestinian factions, including Hamas and Islamic Jihad, expressed their support to Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds.
Jerusalem is our red line, and the Israeli regime will be held accountable for the crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. Jerusalem is the eternal capital of Palestine, and we stand in solidarity with our sons in Jerusalem and will fight alongside them at all costs.
We are all united in the face of the Israeli regime. This is a national battle, and we are all united in protecting Jerusalem al-Quds against the Zionists. The battle is not only in Jerusalem. It's underway in every part of Palestine, and we are ready to sacrifice our lives for Palestine.
Scores of Palestinians have been injured in clashes at the Damascus Gate of the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds, as Palestinian activists confronted hundreds of far-right and extremist Israeli settlers chanting "death to Arabs" in their rally in the center of the occupied city.
The resistance here showed it won't remain silent over the Israeli crimes committed against the Gaza Strip and Jerusalem al-Quds, vowing to defend the Palestinian rights at all costs. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Israel
Israel has admitted its missile system tried but failed to intercept a Syrian missile that landed near the regime's top secret and most sensitive Dimona military nuclear site. Tel Aviv claimed the missile had landed in the Israeli-occupied territories as a result of errant Syrian anti-aircraft fire. Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Benny Gantz said the incident was under investigation. Experts, however, say the path of the projectile flew triggered the speculation that Dimona had been the target. They added that Israel insisted to keep the incident mysterious and it had imposed its own narrative on the media.
Israel tried to keep the incident mysterious. It imposed a specific story on the media that it was a surface-to-air missile and not surface-to-surface missile in an attempt, maybe, to hide the identity of who's behind the attack. Israel's so-called Iron Dome missile shield has failed to intercept and down the missile.
The Israeli military said that in response to the launch, it attacked several missile batteries in Syria, including the one that fired the projectile that struck its territory. Syria's state news agency said Syrian air defense intercepted the Israeli attack that targeted areas in the Damascus suburbs. Israeli officials were angered by what happened. Avigdor Lieberman, former Minister of Military Affairs and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's rival, said the regime had no functioning government and the power of the deterrence is spent.
The missile fire was kind of a surprise even on the political level. We read Israeli official statements. They were trading excuses, like Lieberman and others. The message was strong and clear, and it has affected Israel's strategic security image. It was an incident that was seen as a response to the various confrontations between Iran and Israel. Israel is not in its best situation. Israel feels threatened.
The incident happened only weeks after Israel said it had upgraded Iron Dome in a latest step in Mideast arms race. These upgrades included the ability to knock out threats at higher and lower altitudes and to strike longer numbers of incoming rockets could be fired mainly from Lebanon, Syria, and the besieged Gaza Strip. Tel Aviv has always praised its own Iron Dome missile defense system in repelling attacks, but this time it failed to intercept the Syrian-fired missile, which Israel said landed near its nuclear site, underscoring Tel Aviv's military fragility. Mona Kandil, occupied Albire.
Pakistan has called out army to help police and other paramilitary personnel to enforce strict precautionary measures in bazaars and streets to contain what the government says a sudden surge in COVID-19 cases.
Agar humne ab ittiyat na ki.
Prime Minister Imran Khan in a televised address warned the nation that his country may soon be facing a grim situation similar to that of India, where on an average 2,000 people die every day and more than 300,000 test positive.
I have appealed to the people time and again to follow precautionary measures. However, neither people are scared of coronavirus nor they are adopting any precautionary measures. And that is why now there is surge in coronavirus cases.
Under a new decision, Pakistan has shut down schools in regions with a surge in COVID-19 cases. All markets would be closed by 6 p.m. Indoor and outdoor dining have also been banned. Only 50% staff would be allowed to work in private and government offices, while offices would be closed at 2 p.m. On an average, 100 to 150 people die daily, while between 5,000 to 6,000 people test positive every day in 220 million populated country. So far, there are as many as 102,000 total active cases in Pakistan, while nearly 16,900 people have died since March last year. The government has warned the people to get ready to face complete lockdown of major urban centers if they do not put a mask on their faces to contain the virus.
People would die with hunger if government shuts down the cities. There would be shortage of food items like sugar, flour, and oil. What would we do then?
A survey conducted by Gallup Pakistan last month reported that 65% people believe that the government is exaggerating the threat of the COVID-19.
A significant number of people suffer from allergic-linked diseases such as flu, cough,
fever and asthma, and many of them die every spring weather in parts of Pakistan. However, since March last year, the medical nomenclature in Pakistan have changed, and now most of these diseases have been officially classified as COVID-19 cases under what is medically known as PCR testing system, which many medical experts believe are churning out false positive cases. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Despite the lockdown and curfew, thousands took the streets in Paris to protest against the reform of the social security system. The main reform concerns unemployed people who will receive less unemployment benefits. They will suffer an average loss of 20%, and some will even lose 45% of their unemployment compensation, meaning 300 euros less by month. Many will not be able to pay their rent. The demonstrators blame the French government for taking advantage of the COVID crisis to accelerate anti-popular measures.
Those who will be sanctioned by this reform are those who already suffer the most from the decrease in the work volume due to the COVID crisis. All the vulnerable workers who already lost their job and who are not financially supported by the government will become unemployed and will be affected by this reform. Yes, the government takes advantage of the crisis and pushes for unjust reforms.
Cultural workers made the demonstration very lively. They are paying a heavy price due to the outbreak of the COVID-19.
Today, people who work in the cultural sector often return to their parents and have no income anymore. Since more than 1 year, we don't work, we don't earn money, and the government does not propose any solution to us. Culture is part of the freedom of expression. Only the big shows financed by the state will survive, and the others will disappear.
Billions are given to big companies, 500 billion euros. At the same time, these companies fire workers. How is it possible that this government is making the shareholders richer instead of helping the population?
Indeed, the French stock exchange market has reached a very high level with more than 6,000 points. The 40 biggest French companies are doing very well since the COVID crisis, but the majority of the population does not benefit from this. More than 100 symbolic cultural places like the Odeon Theater are occupied since weeks, with protesters vowing to continue demonstrations until their demands are met.
The COVID crisis will inevitably lead to loss of jobs for many workers. Also, if unemployment benefits are affected, these workers will be punished twice. Chris Denhant, Paris.
Proper Nutrition with Brother Sayyid Wahid Alavi in the program The Month of Allah.
Assalamu alaikum everyone, and welcome back to The Month of Allah. In the last program, we talked about the different aspects of how to eat, and I will continue with the same question and try to answer the question. We reached number 3. The sentence of Bismillah should be said before eating the food, and that is to give thanks. Why do we do that? We say thanks to Allah for all the benefits that Allah has given us, and we start every act and deed with the name of Allah. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, if someone starts his eating with the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, I will guarantee that person that he would not be inflicted with any suffering or disease or pain or distress from that food. Bismillah contains the word of Allah. You have the word of Allah in the sentence of Bismillah. And Allah, when you read and study the Quran and the Ahadith, you see that the different names of Allah have different traits or attributes of Allah. They're referring to a certain trait or attribute of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But the name of Allah in itself is a comprehensive name. It contains all the different traits and attributes within it, in the name of Allah. Number four,